Ways and Means to order and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, Division of State Lands. Ann Hennis, would you like to come up and walk us through the packet we got today?
Chair Messerly, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hennis, Director of Division of State Lands. Yesterday and the day before, you had requested various information from us, and in your packet before you is response to those requests. The packet includes a description of the process, which essentially is our administrative rules for the sale and exchange and purchase of land. You asked for information about land sale information, which includes a table of requests that we've had for land sales, as well as the number of requesters and parcels by county. The included also in your packet is a memorandum from me to the chair about the draft DSL strategic plan. These are documents that were provided to the State Land Board last October. And I again need to mention that this is a work in progress, that we still are needing to certainly add a lot more meat to the bones and go out for public comment on it.
And when do you expect to have that adopted?
Well, I hope this summer is my aim. Some of it, frankly, will depend on responding and working with the legislature and trying to complete other priority work as well. But we definitely want this out, to try to get it out by this summer. Another item that you had requested, and I can ask Steve Purchase to come in and to come up and talk for a minute about this. It was about incomplete removal fill applications. He and his staff did go through those applications and provided some interesting information for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations. As Ann indicated, we did have a chance last night to go through the applications that were deemed to be incomplete from the period of January 15th until March 15th. Identified on the second page of our memo what the common errors were that caused people to have their applications deemed to be incomplete. And it's some very simple stuff. It's things dealing with identification of impact and jurisdictional limits so we can determine where the impacts are. Alternative designs and measures that are required under the statute to show to what extent the impacts are occurring. Changes in the hydraulic characteristics of the site, which is also a statutory requirement. And then drawings being the other issue that seems to get people hung up. So with that, we tried to put together the memo that explains that and what we've done to try to correct that. We also put together on the back of the memo an application for completeness checklist, which includes a mark which looks like a number one on all the areas of all the permits that we looked at that were deemed to be incomplete and how many of them met that particular criteria that's in our completeness summary. This is the same checklist that goes back to an applicant telling them what they're missing. So I want to give you some sense of what that was like.
Steve, you mentioned the alternative designs and requirements are in statute or in administrative rule?
In statute and administrative rule.
Any questions, committee?
Thank you.
And while wait,
Don't leave yet.
The other item that you had requested, and this was, I believe, from Representative Johnson, she wanted more information about communication site leases, and we did go back and look at problems that we are having with communication site leases. So I'll ask Steve to talk about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did go back and look at that, and yesterday during the testimony I indicated that we had one communication site company that we were dealing with. Much to my surprise, went back and found out it was actually 10 companies that are currently occupying state land without benefit of lease. The two of the companies that identify in this list that Representative Johnson asked me to identify are companies that we actually have corresponded with and have told them on a number of occasions that they are there without benefit of lease. And I gave a little explanation of each one of those companies and each of the issues. Those two companies both are on previously authorized sites that bought out the previous company but have either refused or not been willing to enter into new leases. So we've been working with them for quite a while to get that resolved. In addition, last summer we made a site inspection to Burns Butte, which is outside of Burns in Harney County, where we have what we commonly refer to as an antenna farm, where there is 9 authorized users, but there are 17 towers and buildings on that site. 8 of those folks are unauthorized uses on Burns Butte. So we held a meeting in Burns with all of our lessees to try to determine who the additional 8 companies are that could either be or are using our site, either are subleasing from our current lessees or have just gone up and constructed buildings and towers. And we received that information last week, and we're still trying to evaluate that. So we still have a number of those trespassers or people who are using our state lands without benefit of lease.
Representative Johnson.
Two responses. I guess the first one is the old lawyer in me that just says, go to court, throw them off, or get the money. And the second one is I run a state agency, and I know how slowly the wheels turn. But it seems to me, given how clear-cut this issue is, how much money is being lost from state coffers at a time of crisis, that acting aggressively to police this up ought to be pretty simple. And I'm just looking for some reassurance that this is a high priority and that your lawyers are being responsive. I know sometimes when you send something over, it takes a long time because there are lots of issues in the queue to get back, but are you getting the kind of service that you need on what seems to me to be a pretty clear-cut legal issue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, we are. We are actively pursuing as best we can, given the staff and the workload at the Department of Justice. We have been in litigation a number of times during this biennium. The most identifiable case was the New Carissa case, where we tied up most of the Department of Justice attorneys for several months in trying to determine that case. So we are getting the kind of service that we need when we have to get to that point of having to go to court. We also have 2 other trespass cases that are in court. So we've got our Department of Justice attorneys working on those issues. It's just a matter of queuing them up, trying to work with the applicant to get them to do the right thing to save us the expense of having to go forward and go to court.
What's the nature of the other 2 trespass cases?
The other 2 trespass cases are folks who have a wharf or a structure on the state waterway that have refused to lease or are outside of the acknowledged comprehensive plan for the county. Under our state rules, we cannot take an action on our state properties that is not consistent with the county comprehensive plan. One particular case, the applicant is not consistent with the county plan. That case has been going on for 6 years. It's been in court for 6 years. And we actually won this case twice, once at the local court, once at the Court of Appeals. We are now back into court to have the court enforce the court order.
Where is that?
Columbia County.
Thank you. Glad I asked.
Does the division have, by statute or by rule, a penalty?
I agree with the representative that it's just unconscionable that companies such as this go on public lands without any approval. I mean, that's pretty basic business. Is there no penalties at this point, or do you negotiate that when you find the trespass?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, there is authority for us to assess a civil penalty for our waterway leasing program, which the legislature gave us last biennium. We have invoked a number of what I will call demand letters, for lack of a better term. When we get to the point where we've got non-responsive responses from our lessees or the people are not willing to move forward, we do send out a demand letter that says you must comply or we have the ability to assess civil penalties. So far to date, we've assessed 1 civil penalty, although we've used the opportunity to express the fact that we can do those with our lessees on many occasions. Sometimes that's all it takes to finally get to that point. But we do have that authority, and we have used it.
Okay, thank you.
I just like would mention on the communication site leases, this is just one example of why we're requesting the position for the property manager, because this would help us be able to monitor a lot more closely and be able to ensure that we have people under lease. The other 2 items I want to call to your attention that were requested One is the summary comparison that looks at the state versus the regulatory approaches with regards to the removal fill program. This is the one, Senator Messerly, that had been provided to you and Senator Farioli and Senator Atkinson a week or two ago. And then the last item that is included in your packet is showing program revenues and expenses by various categories as had been requested by the committee.
Mr. Chair, I have
Morgan.
Some questions that I'd like to ask on the spreadsheet that you gave us that details the expenses and revenues over these different program areas. What I'm curious about here, first of all, is are all of these revenues into the Common School Fund?
That is correct. All these revenues do go into the Common School Fund. Let me ask Cindy to come on up here, Cindy Wickham, because she compiled this.
Okay. And then the other question that I wanted to ask was, are all the expenses deducts from the Common School Fund?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's the field we're playing in. I'm looking at the forestry part of this, and is the assumption that the revenues are the harvest from the state forest lands?
That is correct.
Okay, I'm also looking at this memo that we got from you yesterday that is a report to the state land board for June 11, 2002, and there's information in this about harvest levels and expenses for 0103 and 0305, and I don't understand how you square these numbers to the numbers in that report.
Would you be able to address that? Let me see if I can address that. For the record, I'm Cindy Wickham.
And this may not be the best place to do this. I just want to let you know what questions I have and hope that we can work to get this information back to the committee as soon as possible. The other question that I have here is what exactly are the expenses that are included in the expense bottom line number?
For the record, I'm Cindy Wickham, the fiscal manager at State Lands. Senator Messerly and Representative Morgan, first of all, the memo that we gave you yesterday is the projected budget numbers that forestry provided to the State Land Board. The numbers on the spreadsheet that we gave you today were the actual numbers that were experienced during those fiscal years. So the variance is going to be any difference in the actual experience that we had during that time. For the 9901... for example, the 9901 budgeted numbers, forestry showed expenses at $10.7 million. Our actual forestry expenses for that biennium were $8.6 million, a difference of 2.2. There's actually a saving. So these numbers do not necessarily add to the budgeted numbers. You're comparing actuals to projections.
So the expenses in forestry are the expenses within the Division of State Lands or are the expenses within the Department of Forestry and the Division?
Chair Messerly and Representative Morgan, those are expenses at forestry. We reimburse forestry for their expenses.
And how do you pay, do you also reimburse DSL for expenses?
DSL does not have expenses.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator
Dukes. Did I not hear that Representative Morgan get an answer to her question as to just what all is included in these, or do you know what all forestry does for this $3 million, $4 million?
That would include the cost of staff that are administering the timber sale programs, the staff on the ground, the cost of treatments, for example, planting, pre-commercial thinning, any other forest-related activities. It would also include some of their planning costs in connection with, for example, the Elliott's State Forest Management Plan.
And the HCA and all the related management expenses that they're undergoing.
That's correct. And that's one of the reasons why their costs are going to be higher in the next couple of years because of having to do those planning costs.
I've been curious. Except for 2 years, the years we've been given here, it's pretty much the same. And I was just curious if it's a percentage or if they're actually breaking out their expenses for the forest.
Well, are we going to have them before us? their short order here?
Chair Messerly, Senator Dukes, I believe it is, they submit their actual cost to us, and then we reimburse it, which I believe is different than on the county trust lands where they have an actual percentage.
But isn't there a cap on how much they can expense out?
Sure.
This isn't the right people to ask.
Aren't they going to be coming?
I was going to suggest that it may be more appropriate to ask those more detailed questions to the Department of Forestry. I believe they're coming in next week.
May I continue asking questions?
Well, yes, but if you hold it, just say, it might be appropriate if we can get them in tomorrow to answer this segment of it.
The Department of Forestry. I will give them a call and see if they can be available.
Follow-up to Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With relation to the other areas that you have revenues and expenses for, is it possible to provide the committee with some detail on the expenses? What exactly are the categories that make up the expenses and how much they are? I'm assuming that you must have gone through some kind of process like that when you came up with these bottom line numbers.
Sure. But I could get Chair Messerly, Representative Morgan. We can provide additional detail if I could maybe get some clarity.
Well,
exactly which details you're looking for.
And what I'm interested in is basically, I mean, you must have line items, and there must be accounting expenses and oversight expenses and on-the-ground management expenses that I'm just curious about getting some detail about what exactly it is that's making up these expense numbers. What's bringing them to the bottom line number that they have? And what I'm interested in is, first of all, just what the categories are, and second of all, how complete they are in the accounting that's been done.
We can try to provide that information. I think we may want to talk with you a little bit afterwards
okay.
to make sure we get.
I mean, what I'm looking at here is that there are categories like minerals and rangelands and clearly fill and removal permits where, you got to wonder with the. You've got minerals and rangelands where the expenses about eat up the revenues, and then fill and removal where the expenses are hugely out of line to the revenues. And it would seem that if one of the missions of the agencies is to maximize the revenue going into the Common School Fund, that certainly it would be a good discussion in this committee to talk about how we could minimize the expenses that are related to the programs, or even if it's worthwhile doing this in terms of the revenue that's generated.
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, one thing I do want to point out that I don't believe this shows, for example, for rangelands, is that a number of years ago, before I became director, when there was large controversy about what the grazing fees should be, the legislature did appropriate $3 million from the general fund to the Common School Fund to recognize the differences with those grazing leases. And so this doesn't recognize that amount of money that was already in prior years.
Okay, but, you know, when you got a program that's, I mean, it's a virtual wash between the revenues and the expenses, I think that we as policymakers need to have a discussion about why we're doing this the way that we're doing it.
Or is there a better way to do business? Okay. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. And I don't remember when you were working for forestry on the county forest lands. The Department of Forestry was receiving was it 32% or 34% for managing those lands? Was there a difference between that formula and the common school ground? Do you remember?
Chair Messerly, Representative Krieger, there is a difference in the way they are reimbursed on the county forest lands. There's a percentage that of money from the revenues that go for management purposes. For the Common School Fund, it is actual expenses that we reimburse them for. And Senator Meserly did ask, I'll try to see if I can have someone from the Department of Forestry come in tomorrow to answer any specific questions you have.
Okay.
I assume that you'll be taking public testimony now, and we'll come back later.
Yep. What I'm going to do is call some people up who have signed up for public testimony today, and we will be here tomorrow to finish up with the department's presentations, and we'll also have time for public testimony tomorrow again at 1 o'clock, 1 to 3. So first I'd like to call John Rosenberger. I'll bring you up two at a time, and Hal Salwasser, please.
Welcome. Good afternoon. Chair Meserly, members of the Commission, I'm John Rosenberger. I'm the Deputy Director of the Highway Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here today to testify in support of Division of State Lands Enhancement Program Package number 107. That's the environmental permitting package. That will do two things for the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Highway Division in particular. It will provide faster turnaround times for our permits that we need for bridge and highway projects, and it will also provide a higher level of technical assistance to the department as we put those permits together. We, I believe, are about 15% of the permits that the Division of State Lands issues, and we're looking at with our OTIA program, the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, the bonding package from the last legislature, and our bridge program, that will increase by about 25%. So we are very supportive of this package and hopefully can deliver more highway projects for the state of Oregon. And with that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Let me first ask the Department of Transportation now funds a staff member at DSL, is that right?
Chair Meserly, I don't know. I can find that out for you. I'm not sure.
I'm getting the nods, yes.
Good.
So this would be the second position, Mr. Chair?
Well, let's ask that. Is this an additional position besides that? Okay, we're here. Let the record show there's a nod, yes. Further questions?
I would be curious about where the funding is coming from to pay for this position.
Chair Meserly, Representative Morgan, it would come out of the State Highway Fund for projects. That's gas tax, state shared revenues,
okay.
And federal funds.
Okay. Senator Dukes?
The package in the book says provides two FTEs, so this is two more people? Just one more to equal to?
And we need you to come up and talk to the mic.
For limited direction, this will give you...
The legislature approved one limited duration position, or I should say the E-Board did. This, and that was a limited duration position. The program option package asked for two limited duration positions in the next biennium. So it'd be one more than what we currently have in this biennium.
Do we only do this if the new package passes supposedly targeted at bridges, or is this needed for OTIA, which we're already in the middle of?
It's probably not a clear review.
You want to pull up another chair?
Yeah, right.
We've got lots of them.
Musical chair.
Chair Meserly, Senator Duke, it's for both. We have a current bridge program that we are working on, and it will assist us in the permits for the current program. We are also doing the environmental work for about 400 bridges. If there is a bridge package that does pass this session, all 400 of those bridges will need some type of permitting. It also would help assist us with the OTIA program that is geared up, and we will have a number of more projects out this year, this coming biennium.
So we might want to kind of wait and see how the other bill moves.
Representative Morgan.
So would we be correct in presuming that, these are mostly wetlands issues that are going to be regulated here?
Wetland and waterway issues.
And waterway issues? I suppose I could make an editorial comment at this point, but I'll restrain myself.
Appreciate that. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Salwasser.
Chair Messerly and members of the committee, I'm Hal Salwasser, Dean of the College of Forestry, Director of the Oregon Forest Research Lab, and Interim Director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University. And I'm here to support the requested funding for the Oregon Natural Areas Program. As the Interim Director of the Institute, I oversee the administration of the Oregon Natural Heritage Information Center. And that center used to be the Natural Areas Program database. It's now become part of OSU and the Institute. But the rest of the state's Natural Areas Program remains with the Division of State Lands and the State Land Board. Oregon State University is working hard to assure that both timber and ranching remain viable industries in this state and that our forests and rangelands continue to provide environmental benefits. The state's Natural Areas Program gives us the baseline reference points for these goals. The Natural Areas Program involves no regulations. It works through volunteer efforts of the Council along with interagency Oregon and Washington Natural Areas Committee, and thus provides direction to state and federal agencies as well as counties and local governments on the significance of the natural areas. Much of the funding requested goes to support the updating of the Natural Heritage Plan. This plan allows the state to influence federal agency natural area policy and helps ensure that state and federal programs are complementary. Keeping this program also allows the state to obtain federal funding, which promotes research at Oregon State University. Overall, it's a small investment that supports a volunteer advisory council and maintains a natural area program that assists the state in assuring that we can have sustainable and productive natural resources as a basis of our economy. And I'd be pleased to take any questions you might have.
I think, Doctor, the reason we are interested in having you come testify to us, the question arose whether that would be more appropriate for that council to be with your Natural Resource Institute where the database is.
Mr. Chair, the council provides advice to the State Land Board on the acceptance of properties into the registry. It's a political and administrative process that is not a normal kind of a function for a university to carry out for a state, so I would think we would want to take a look at whether it's appropriate for a university to be having that sort of a policy role, but we'd be open to consider it.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to make the question even broader. Are there other aspects of some of the management work that DSL does of natural spaces, or I'm thinking we talked a little bit, and I'm mucking around in Senator Messerly's district again, but we had talked a little bit about South Slough or some of the other things that fit under this general topic that would be appropriate in these troubled economic times to think about maybe the university accepting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I haven't given any thought to that. I know the university could play a partnership role with state agencies in the administration of properties such as South Slough, and may already be doing that to some degree.
I'm using that as an example,
yeah.
Not a specific.
I think you're giving him a heart attack.
if this comes as an unfunded mandate to the university, it would give me a heart attack.
Pretty good, Representative.
Just slip that in there. Thank you. I know I put you on the spot by asking you the question. I guess is all I'm trying to do is just to prompt some thinking about what are different ways that any of the agencies, we happen to be dealing with this budget right now, but any of the agencies that are looking over their portfolio and thinking, are there different ways to mix and match what we're doing? Not just keep doing the same old thing because it's memorialized in statute, not that following statute is bad, but to perhaps ask the legislature for a different model. That was it. The only other thing I'd add is I know you look familiar when I walked in the room, and I, all of a sudden realizing that it's your presence in our home with regularity on your television ads, which I think are very useful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, Representative Johnson, I appreciate that comment. Our interim president told me the other day that he had to go to sleep with me on his mind because it was the last thing he saw on TV. With regard to your question about appropriate roles for the university, I think it's useful to think the university's strengths are in science, education, and public outreach. The university is not generally well equipped as a property manager other than to manage the properties that are supporting the research, teaching, and outreach functions of the university. So if there are properties that state agencies are managing that have those principal functions, there would be a natural fit. If the function is to make money, the university is not particularly adept at figuring out how to make money from property management, except for the college forest, of course.
You're having a bad day, aren't you?
The week is not out.
Almost like that's in the line.
Okay, any other questions?
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call Ron Steffens and Bill Ray.
Church teaching is bullying.
Good morning, Chair Messerly and the committee. My name is Ron Steffens, and I'm a current president of the Friends of South SLU. I'm here today to just refresh you all a little bit on our relationship and to hand out something hot off the presses. The Friends of South SLU have been active in the formation of the SLU as well as in over the years. The last few years we've been more active in fundraising, and we're very pleased to have helped to complete the Interpretive Center remodel. We're now working on the inside of the Interpretive Center so that the science and the education and the research that goes on at the South SLU can reach a wider audience and in a little more modern ways. Specifically, if you flip to the back of my testimony, I'm here to talk about Program Option Package 103 as well as a supplemental budget request for five staff positions, and generally to give you feedback from the community's point of view. The South SLU is something that's very successful, and if you are looking to assign it anywhere, the Friends would certainly take a piece of it, but
don't repeat that.
I don't think we're quite up to that either, but we love our partnership and our ability to support a very innovative part of our community. I think the history and the culture and the natural history all come together, both in the watershed and in the what I refer to as the tidal ooze, because so many folks who like South SLU have been stuck in the mud one way or the other out there. Basically, we see this as a place that has the strength of a three-legged stool. It has federal funding, state funding, and local community support. And we want to support that and continue helping with that. And the newsletter is one sort of a part of our renovation as a Friends group. We started out doing something called the Mini Tide when I first moved to Coos Bay 10 years ago, just about. And this is a kind of an upscale version. I teach journalism at the community college, and so I involved a graduate who was looking for some real-world experience, and he did the layout and helped do the writing. And if there's any questions, we'd be glad to help answer that, and just in support of continuing the good partnerships that are happening down in the SLU.
Well, thank you, Ron. Appreciate the work you folks do, and it is an important part of the sanctuary. We had a brief discussion yesterday about the expenditures of the sanctuary. Since you're here, I'll ask you for your sense of it. And it became apparent that roughly the cost of operating the sanctuary are split between the federal government and the common school fund. And the question arose if there, well, it became apparent that there were no fees charged for any of the work that the sanctuary does. Do you have a sense of how the public or the tourist industry or maybe in some of the schools that come and take tours would react to a nominal fee?
There is a nominal fee in that we have a really nice box out front that people donate to, and we put all that back into the SLU. I was out there a fair amount at spring break last week, and it was very actively used both in the trails and inside the exhibit area. I would have a sense that schools in these trying times might be leery of field trips that are also tied to fees, although they often, I do know they donate and cover expenses and things like that. I worked for the National Park Service in the summer, and that's an agency that's very familiar with charging fees, and I know the expense that goes into setting up a fee collection process. So there would be pros and cons to use fees. Right now, I think it does provide sort of that. You have Cape Arago and Shore Acres, and those are all fee-based areas. And I think it is an option for the community as well as tourists to stretch their legs and to really get into the SLU takes some effort, and some people consider that part of the expense. Cost-benefit may not be there, and I think we're proud of the fact that, in fact, the South SLU Commission just authorized Saturday staffing year-round, and by shifting positions through the week, they managed to do that with relatively little cost increase, if any. The educational part of it would be hindered by fees. The budget might benefit.
About the tourist segment, there are people that, as their tourists coming through the area, stopping.
There's a larger tourism, environmental tourism work that's going on called the Coastal Environments Learning Network, and there's a hub in the North Bend Tourism Center that spreads people out to a number of non-fee areas as well as one or two fee areas. I think tourists get surprised sometimes when they show up and they have to get the checkbook out, or in a perfect world, there would be one Oregon Coast Pass, and that would get you everywhere, and people would love to buy it. But right now, I think there's two possible passes you could get. I could be wrong, because I haven't got my passes yet this year. And add another fee at another different kind of agency would be problematic, perhaps.
Doesn't the Friends of the South SLU operate the gift shop?
Yep, better. Yes, there's gift shop and bookstore. And
and where do those revenues?
Those are, for instance, we've got about $15,000 now to leverage our grant writing that will then leverage the $200,000 if everything comes together to do the interpretive center. So those usually get put back into kind of unique expenses or fundraising. The bookstore is also supplemented by special programs. We'll have a modest fee, and that's another fundraiser.
So those funds go to the Friends, or are they turned over to the SLU?
They're managed by the Friends, and then as needed, the Friends assign them to we do a Christmas gift, and then we do things like the matching funds.
Okay. Any other questions, committee? Thank you, Ron. Oh, excuse me, Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned fundraising.
Yes.
Tell me about the Friends fundraising efforts.
We used one of our co-board members, and he's on the South SLU Commission, is active fundraising for libraries in Bandon. So we decided to do brick sales as one piece of it. A pretty significant mailing campaign in Coos County the last year or two. Word of mouth and just inviting people out and saying this is a good spot. When we were demonstrating local fundraising, we then used that to write grants with the expertise of the staff members and our experience. And we've had Ford Family Foundation, the Abandoned Dunes, a number of both local and regional, often science-based foundations providing funds.
and that's where we're at now to try to. The interpretive center is completed. There's a classroom that's functional but not state of the art at all, and there's a wonderful meeting room. And in fact, I think we're trying to invite the state land board to come down and meet there. And that meeting room doesn't have real current exhibits to help explain the science as well as the restoration projects.
Do you happen to know how much you raised last year?
Per year, I couldn't give you a figure today, but in the first phase of the campaign, we raised about $145,000, and one of those was a $60,000 grant, and the rest of it was smaller grants. And locally, it was, I think, about $25,000 to $30,000. And this year, we've raised $15,000 through donations and bookstore sales.
Mr. Chair, I seem to recall last session there were some similar discussions about the cost to the Common School Fund of operations, and I thought we were going to try to get more help and more support from the Friends organization. Perhaps that didn't trickle on down. The package that you've got, 103, is that all federally funded?
I am not an expert on the budget. Do you recall?
I think, Senator, we can ask the staff that when we get back.
Because I have other questions about staffing and response to direction that we gave last session and stuff like that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you for coming up, Ron. Appreciate your time here.
Bill Ray. And could we have Phil Scholes come up, too?
My name is Bill Ray. I'm with LDC Design Group, where I'm the Director of Environmental Planning. Currently, we represent some of the largest home builders in Oregon in the development process. As a result of this, I'm in consistent and constant interaction with ODSL. Primarily, I'm here to state that we would like to see their current level of staffing and funding remain. With the wetland delineation program that we are now incorporating, there are four principles at ODSL that we have to work with. They cover the entire state. In Washington County, in the metro area, my land use applications cannot even get deemed complete until I have concurrence on a wetland delineation. The alternative of moving the wetland delineation and concurrence program over to the Corps is not viable at this time, in my opinion, because the Corps is not doing wetland delineation concurrence, nor do they have they experienced any desire to do so. Without that ability to find the limits of the resources that we're charged to protect, my developments can't move forward. So I need access to those staff members. As a whole, I've found the Wetlands Division of ODSL to be responsive. We have disagreed at times. We have disagreed vehemently at times. But to this date, I've been able to work through those situations. Within the department, if I have a concern, I've found it relatively easy to go on up the chain of command and have direct contact with supervisors, with assistance to the directors and the director of herself. I found these members to be very approachable. I've been in the profession for 22 years, 15 years in Florida, with extensive wetland regulations, land use regulations, then out here. With regards to the removal fill, same type of procedure. I've found the ODSL staff much more approachable than at times the Corps staff, and then also on other projects I found the Corps also very approachable. But the fact is that we have an interdependency of land use regulations that are based upon input from ODSL. Without their input and without my ability to access them directly, many of the county's land use entitlement and development procedures come to a screeching halt. It's not a case of where they're postponed or where they're slowed down. We can't even get to the process to where they will even review a land use application. So in regards to, you know, specifically staffing, I don't at this time want to get into any of the current rules and or regulations. But with regards to staffing, I would strongly recommend that we leave the staffing where it's at its current level of funding. At that point, you know, I can pretty much, you know, answer any questions you may have, and I appreciate the opportunity to come forward and speak.
Thank you. Have you, could you give us comments? I know that the Corps of Engineers and the Division of State Lands requirements differ. In some cases, the Corps of Engineers requires more, and in some cases, DSL requires more. Does that create difficulty in, to the permit applicant?
Yes. I've been out here approximately 3 years. Realized coming from Florida, we're drawing five lines on the map. You have the state agency that has a wetland delineation procedure that they feel is better than the Corps. The Corps, water management districts, county regulations, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So you're never on the same page. Out here I'm only having to deal with two agencies. The discrepancy between the two I have been able to resolve at this point. It's more of a case-by-case rather than a general trend. Some of the discussions have come up on use of the Food Securities Act manual for definitions of wetlands. From my professional opinion, that discussion should not even be on the table. The Swamp Busters Act was written for a different procedure. It was written for a different set of circumstances. It was not an ecological protection ordinance that was written in result of the 401 Clean Water Act or the 404 Act. So that is where we come into some differences. But again, my clients specifically are wanting us to get the project moving forward. And we have been able to work out solutions, but they're negotiated. They're not really a clear cut. This is where your answer is going to be every time. The assumption process we're going through, I sit on that technical advisory committee, have been involved with it. My professional opinion at this time is that we still have quite a ways to go. We have a huge issue to overcome, and that is the interaction with, you know, ESA consultation and two federal agencies. And current staffing levels, you know, again, I don't want to get into that at this point here, but it's again, it's, there are some differences between the two, but the Corps typically has I've seen them take a less active role, I guess is to say, and allow ODSL to take the lead. I've not had as much interaction with them.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, committee?
Mr. Chair, if you would.
Representative Morgan.
I'm curious with the comparison that you made between the regulatory agencies that you needed to work through on water, wetland, clean water type issues in Florida and what you're describing in Oregon. Because my estimation would be that if you were developing in the metro area, in areas where there were clean water issues and wetlands issues, that you'd probably have to go through quite a number of agencies. And the list that I put down was DSL, DEQ, DLCD, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, possibly the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, and NIFS or NOAA's fisheries. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we grapple with routinely in this body is the complexity of permitting, and that you get dragged through agency after agency after agency on the state level, and then you've got a federal piece of it that you often have to go through too. And DSL has been working very hard to get rid of the connection between the Corps and the division on the fill and removal permits. that we haven't been nearly so successful on the ESA issues that we have to work through. So I think we do recognize clearly that part of what we can do within the state to streamline permitting for people that conduct activities like you do on the ground are to try to work programmatic permits that go down through agencies and then laterally across agencies too, so that the biggest portholes that people have to go through in terms of permitting are as streamlined as they can be within the agencies and then across the agencies. And I think that from a policy point of view, we look at this in terms of economic development, because clearly the shortest amount of time that a development concept has to spend in the permitting process, and the more certainty that you have that you're going to get out of the process with what you need, and the least amount of money that you have to put in to getting out of the process with what you have to need, is an optimum situation from the point of view of economic development. And I honestly believe that we have a lot of ground to cover in Oregon before we're at a place where we can say that we've done a good job at that.
You're correct. There's a federal program that, as a state, you don't have control over. There is interaction to be included in that, and they mirror each other, or, you know, basically mirror each other. You have some overlap with the Clean Water Act, delegation to EPA, delegation to DEQ. And then we have DEQ and ODSL at times fulfilling similar requirements. You have U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Oregon Fish and Wildlife. You have, and of course, NIMS involved in there as the odd man out. We're all trying to figure out how to work with him. And here's an agency that has traditionally not been in the regulatory business, from certainly a land use prospect, and they've come at it from a completely different perspective than U.S. Fish and Wildlife comes at it. My clients, which is principally such as West Hills Development, we've done permitted over 3,000 units in the past, 2 years. The problem that they consistently have is the land within the metro area is at such a premium that you have developers bidding against it that they have to go hard with capital before they even know how much usable land they have. And that is a out-of-pocket development cost. And so they're well into the process with time value of money to where they're expending revenues with no idea how much, developable land they get. When we bring in the local agencies in Washington County, such as Clean Water Services, we cannot even get a complete development application to get in the pipeline until we have a service provider letter. The service provider letter requires concurrence on a wetland delineation. And at times, such as Phil and myself, we find ourselves with a myriad of regulations in front of us trying to, at times you wonder which ball is going to fall out of the air first. And so it is extensive. It is complicated. The sooner we can get answers, the better. We, as consultants, have to be able to have direct contact with the regulatory agencies, and we have to get conscientious, forthright, and quick responses from them. Some of these responses, need to be done in 15 and 30 days rather than 45 and 60 and 90 days.
I think that there's a huge need, too, to integrate the process so that things are happening concurrently rather than that you finish one thing, you start the next thing. And that I know that consultants are getting better and better at working the system so that things are beginning concurrently, but I don't think that as a state policy we make it very easy for that to happen. And I think on top of all the things that you described, that you have to lay this really quirky land use planning system and all of its regulations on top of that, which adds a whole other layer of complication to it too. And I think that that is one of our big challenges here, is that we have all these state separate and discrete state agencies that do a certain amount of cooperating together, but that there needs to be a huge amount more of that in order for us to overcome the impediments that we're creating to economic development.
You're correct. There, what I can bring to the discussion is experience in other regions that have experienced phenomenal growth rates and have had to deal with extensive environmental considerations. The road that you have in front of you is, having been through the process before, having worked in the 404 assumption process for a number of years and then elected to back away from it, these are things that I know are in the pipeline. And you know, we spent 3 years on legislation in Florida trying to combine those things. We created an overall environmental resource permit, designated one lead agency, and agreed that this is the way it was going to be done. That was not an easy battle. You know, we lost on the floor twice before finally coming up again as a rider on another bill. You're well aware of what that takes to get legislation through. But right now it is difficult for developers to develop in Oregon. And it is very difficult for them to put up the amount of risk capital that it requires to move forward with the uncertainties that are out there.
May I ask one more?
We need to move along.
Yeah.
I have one more question. One of the issues that I think we recognize as an impediment to development in Oregon is our adversity to take risk in environmental areas, and that we require developers to do a lot of consultant work to try to assess risks. Can you talk to us about the cost that adds to development?
You have to look at it as projects are on case by case. It would be unfair at this time for me to say that, you know, it is X number of dollars per unit that it costs. I can say that at times we're not sure where they're coming from, and when we get into risk analysis and some of the ecological risk analysis as consultants, we're not sure where we're going to end up, you know, once we start down that path. That's a difficult problem to try and address in a simplistic, you know, response. But yeah, there's some definite things that are done differently in different areas that I'm familiar with, better or worse. I have my personal opinions on those, but you know, we're trying to work within the framework right now that we have, and I know it does cost developers an extensive amount of money to get past what is considered a reasonable or acceptable level of risk to no risk. Some of you can't reach.
Let's move along. And sir, if
Thank
you could just stay there, we might have other questions for you after Mr. Scholes.
Hi, my name is Phil Scholes. I am a professional wetland scientist. I have a wetland consulting firm in Portland, employing about 4 or 5 people. And I tend to work from the North Coast down to the South Coast, Medford, and Central Oregon. So I do get to see a lot of the state and different kinds of conditions. I've indicated on the sign-up sheet that I'm neutral on this issue of the budget here. But I felt that there were some things that were really pertinent for me to state. I've probably been one of the bigger critics of DSL for the last 2 years. I've met numerous times with DSL staff, the assistant directors, trying to address a lot of concerns and issues I've had. And they've agreed to meet with me almost every time and been very, you know, responsive in that respect, and very appreciative of that. And also, since the implementation of Senate Bill 529, I think that there has been some significant improvements in DSL's permit processing that is, in some cases, it's shortening the amount of time to get a permit, sometimes by half. I think there is quite a bit of room for improvement with the streamlining, and I guess my request for, in terms of budgeting, that in
to have one of the full-time employees actually their job description be streamlining within the agency. I think that there's a lot of opportunity in a year or 2 years of one individual, you know, developing everything from forms to working with, some of those resource agencies to try to come up with things that take less time on both their staff as well as the people that submit applications. Right now I am working with other consultants and division on legislative work group for House Bill 2431, which I guess in the future is going to be known as House Bill 2293. And it's about making a number of fine-tuning to the removal of fill law. And I think we're making a lot of progress in terms of trying to address some of the issues. But regardless of those kinds of changes to the statute, I think that there's a lot of internal sort of streamlining that would be really useful. So my suggestion is to create not a new position, but use one of their existing folks for that type of task, and also see if it's possible to have some kind of committee that reports back to the legislature of sort of an advisory group on that streamlining stuff to sort of keep the agenda going and keep ideas coming in. I do want to say that I think the state DSL is moving in the right direction with what is known as the SPGP program, the State Programmatic General Permit. I think that's a way of reducing the federal role on a lot of kind of permit situations, and I would support, you know, moving in that direction. That's pretty much what I was planning on testifying. I did want to respond to Representative Morgan's concerns, if that's possible, regarding the resource agencies such as DEQ, ODFNW, and so on. Those agencies often are a pretty big hang-up in our permitting process, and a lot of times they're bringing up issues that have already been stated in our permitting process. ODFNW is a pretty good example of one that lists a bunch of conditions that are already the responsibility of Division State Lands, and it just makes it that much more work for both DSL and us to work through their comments. And so I think that there's an opportunity for those agencies like that and DEQ to write down what their primary concerns are and maybe even make some recommendations and give them to DSL on an annual basis, something that makes them make fewer repetitious comments, you know, time after time. In our work group on HB 2431, we're suggesting that a 75-day window that DEQ has for issuing comments be reduced down to the 30 days that all the other agencies would have. I'm sure they would feel strongly about not wanting that window reduced, but the reality is DSL often issues a permit and DEQ still hasn't provided comments because they're allowed to have a longer time. And my gut feeling is that agency should be able to provide comments just as quickly as the others, even though it might not be the thing that they'd like to hear. And I think that with the issue that Mr. Ray brought up regarding clean water services creating extra levels of requirements, I think that there is some opportunity to get either the statute or some other language added to the statute that restricts those kinds of agencies from requiring DSL to provide a reviewed delineation for their own land use process. You know, DSL does quite a bit of reviewing delineations for removal fill purposes. They shouldn't be forced to do it for clean water services. My feeling is clean water services can go out and hire their own consultant or delineators to check reports if they want to for their own purposes, but to hold someone else up or put an extra burden on Division State Lands is probably not a very fair thing to do. So, and I think there's other state agencies, you have sort of a similar issue. They have some of their own agendas. It'd be nice if they just sort of write them down and give them to DSL in advance and limit their comments to things that are pertinent to specific applications.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'd ask either one of you to respond. Given that you both work extensively, particularly you, sir, across a lot of agencies, would you see any benefit in having any consolidation of agency functions into, say, some kind of natural resource agency rather than broken down into its constituent parts that may or may not communicate well with each other?
I think at some levels that would be true with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. You know, you sometimes their fish biologists are only pulled in at the very last moment, when maybe there's an opportunity to have someone fisheries expertise at DSL that can analyze a situation right there, either on the spot, or provide some training for some other people. Because a lot of times it comes down to disagreements between what a consultant might assert about maybe a fisheries issue and the professional opinion of Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I think there's some opportunity there. It might simply be maybe a similar kind of approach that ODOT is having with maybe there should be a full-time staff member funded by Department of Fish and Wildlife at the DSL that does that function, so that they have fewer places to go to get the comments.
The consolidation is a torturous procedure to work down, because you have so many agencies with their interpersonal agendas. But again, the duplication of effort, where we come in, we have a removal fill permit, we're addressing wildlife habitat associated with a state listed species. We're waiting on input from ODF and W, and the comments that they make are comments that we have heard for 2 and 3 years, and they could have been answered 45 days earlier with interactions, you know, simply from a representative at ODSL who is reviewing the removal fill permit. They're interacting with us right now. Both Phil and I have every one of these agencies on our speed dial. And you end up having a notebook of people that you have to know to get your product to move forward. And if one person is out of the office, out on vacation, you can get delayed 15, 30, 45 days. You miss a real estate closing. You miss a grading permit. You miss a dry weather construction window. And now you've held up a project not for 30 or 45 days. You've held up a project for a year. And that has serious economic impact upon a developer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call Mr. Key and Mr. Montaigne.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. My name is Jeffrey Key, and I'm here to support Division of State Lands Wetland Regulatory Program and Division of State Lands Operations Budget. I'm a fourth generation native Oregonian, descendant from loggers, ranchers, and teachers. I've been working with Oregon Regulatory Program since 1994. I want to give my support for the protection of wetlands and waterways in Oregon and support the staff at the Division of State Lands for their implementation of an important regulatory program. I just want to point out some of the importance of the wetlands. There are at least 15 recognized values and functions that have been identified, and I trust that you guys will receive my written testimony also so that you can read through all 15 of them. But for me, you know, flood storage, sediment control, wildlife habitat, open space and recreation are some of the most important. My favorite is recreation because I'm a hunter and a fisherman. There have been a few studies that have estimated the economic values of wetland protection. The most well-known is probably the Massachusetts Natural Valley Storage Investigation. This study looked at the economic benefits of protecting 8,000 acres through established easements of wetlands along floodplains in the St. Charles River. These easements had an annual cost of $477,000, but the resulted economic gain was estimated at $722,000, of which $125,000 was associated with recreation. This natural storage project continues to serve its citizens, providing substantial human values in the reduction of flood impacts while protecting interests in boating, hiking, and fishing. Protecting wetlands is good for the economy, Oregonians, and livability. Studies conducted by the Department of Agriculture have found that 363 terrestrial species in the Great Basin
288 of them are directly dependent or disproportionately utilized riparian zones. These are important areas to protect. In my experience, these regulatory programs have never stopped a development project. DSL staff provide checks and sounding boards to reduce impacts. Seldom can they eliminate them. My work with them has always been more of a collaboration than regulation. Even when I've had clients dealing with blatant violations of state law, DSL did not come in and levy fines or place liens on the property. They worked with myself and the client to remedy the problem and restore the wetland while allowing the client to have the control of the replanting and landscaping plans. The recent changes that have come about in the regulatory program have brought more certainty and consistency to wetland regulation in Oregon. Now is not the time to reduce protective measures on a resource that will benefit future generations. Oregon's wetland regulations do not prevent or put an unnecessary burden on development. These regulations just require good planning. The staff at DSL is a bright, dedicated, practical group who know who their bosses are. They all know the value of wetlands and protecting them, and that is why they are doing what they do. I support the current program and its staff and would urge our representatives not to reduce, but even try to increase current funding levels.
Thank you very much. Questions? Comments? Sir?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am here today to offer testimony in support of the Oregon Natural Heritage Program and the Division of State Lands budget items supporting that program. My name is Roland Montag. I reside at 4997 Pettyjohn Road, South Salem, Oregon. I'm retired and currently serve as one of the 9 volunteer members of the Oregon Natural Heritage Advisory Council, filling one of the 4 scientific slots on that council. My professional background is fishery science and natural resource management. Jimmy Keegan, past manager of the Oregon Natural Heritage Program and current manager of OSU's Natural Heritage Information Center, was unable to attend this hearing. He's out of town, and he's asked me to submit his testimony. Mr. Chairman, with your permission and members of the committee's permission, I would simply like to provide that written testimony for your later review rather than read it into the
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Other speakers, Hal Selwasser and the written testimony by Jimmy Keegan, those individuals have really covered the historic and administrative purposes of the program. What I would like to do is keep my comments mercifully brief and focus on the functional on-ground aspects of the program. Let me for a moment define what I mean by on-ground. Part of my background in years past was owning a consulting firm, and I provided services to businesses and local governments and individuals attempting to permit projects on the ground. Bill Ray, I think, today illustrated what I'm talking about in terms of on ground. There are many users for the information that comes from the Natural Heritage Program, but there's a certain group of users that finds it most useful and is one of the hardest groups to reach. In the simplest of terms, the production of sound, verifiable information, access to that information, is the hallmark of this program. The term verifiable becomes extremely important in the successful development of any project. The verifiable aspect often makes the difference between an orderly planning process or a project development process, and is, in the worst case, litigation causes litigation and long, costly delays if it is not verifiable. It's the quality of information and one's ability to verify its accuracy that often makes the difference. In questions relating to impacts and enhancements to our natural resource base, the existence of solid baseline data is critical. Those of us who have worked in the Endangered Species Act understand this principle all too well. The closer you get to the individual landowner, the watershed council, or the local government, the more critical this verifiable information becomes to the success of their project or process. The reason simply is that individuals and small local governments do not generally have the technical resources and knowledge of the system to enable them to ferret out bits and pieces of technical information relevant to their project. City of Portland, larger groups have access to sophisticated consultants. The locals very often do not, as does the local property owner. The ability to access a central location that has an organized database and broad baseline data often makes the difference between an orderly process and disaster. The Oregon Natural Heritage Program is a program process designed to provide the critical baseline information. The program was set up by the legislature to pool this information in a place and manner that would facilitate access by agencies, local governments, and individuals. The process has been generally successful through the years in providing scientists, planners, managers, and developers with the necessary verifiable information to move forward with their research, their projects, and their permits. Functionally, the program has three parts. Acquisition of natural areas using a structured and scientific valid process of volunteer acquisition. This is facilitated by the Citizens Advisory Council, of which I'm a member. Writing a report describing the program and outlining the processes to date. It's updated every 5 years. It's in the process of being updated now. And the establishment of a database that is easily accessible. The process is driven by a voluntary Citizens Advisory Council. Currently, the database portion of the program has moved to OSU. The transfer of the information management portion of the program to OSU has been a major and a very positive addition to the overall effort. But the program still has three parts. OSU's Natural Resource Information Center is the reservoir. The Natural Heritage Program is the pipeline. The long-term success of our efforts to plan and manage our natural resource base and survive policy and permitting at the end-user level will depend on our ability to provide a comprehensive database with wide geography and scope. We have not completed that task. The current funding level for the National Heritage Program is $15,000 per year, $30,000 for the biennium. The appropriation under consideration for the next fiscal year will cover the publication of the updated report currently being updated. This year's update will include new geological information not contained in past reports. The total cost of producing this report, inclusions of new information, and edit of the report is supported to a large degree by grants and matching money tied to the $15,000 general fund seed money. Much of the editing and some of the drafting of the report is driven by volunteer efforts of the Advisory Council members. The catalyst for these efforts is the annual $15,000 seed money. Without that contribution of seed money, the pipeline will cease to exist, and the flow of new and expanded information to OSU's Information Center will be reduced, and the objective for a more comprehensive statewide database seriously compromised. The practical aspect is not the loss of the program, but the impact on the end user.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call Chuck Bennett and Glenn Stonebrink.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I'm here representing, I hope, the feelings of the beneficiaries of the work done by DSL and the Land Board, the K-12 system. We have found the department very helpful. This is new for K-12, surprisingly. I was surprised when I found this when I came to work for COSA. The Common School Fund had been a small fund and one that had not attracted a great deal of interest in the education community, and we began taking a look at its size, at its stability, and the resulting income from it, and found that it actually was one of the more stable funding sources while still fairly small and growing. And that was unusual, as you'll recall, over the past few years in K-12 funding. So we made contact with the department and have found them to be very helpful in educating us to the program they offer. With that in mind, we've learned enough to realize that the portion of the program of real interest to us is as aggressive a management program of the assets as possible. And that includes every aspect of the program. With that in mind, I'd ask you to take a close look at supporting enhancement packages 101, 102, 106, and 110. I think these are consistent with that approach. We're asking you to continue to the limited duration positions relative to wetland and range management, strengthening the unclaimed properties portion of the program through, again, continuing two limited duration positions, improve the trust property fiscal controls and public outreach, as well as the Eastern Oregon Properties Manager. Ms. Chairman, I'm not going to go into any great detail on the relationships here, but I know, as you and the members know, the trust lands managed by the division, as well as the remainder of the assets managed by the division, are being managed with a trust responsibility and a trust relationship with the Common School Fund and thereby with the School Children of Oregon. We've been very pleased with the management as well as the land board's approach in this aspect, in this relationship, and feel strongly that fees should pay for the cost of the programs, that lease fees should be at the going market rate, that sale of property should be at market rate, that as many trees as possible should be cut on forest lands, that where mining is possible, mining should occur, that what this is about is maximizing income to the Common School Fund. And in any point, and we're trying to understand better and better what the division does and what the land board's decision process is like, we are extremely interested in seeing maximization of that approach by the department. We think that these portions of the decision package will help. We know it's not perfect, but we think there are going to be, over time, some real growth in division's management activities. Thank you.
I'm wondering, Mr. Bennett, I don't know if you're here when we were going over the information that was presented to us this morning, or the beginning of the hearing, I should say. But in the function of removal and fill permits, the expenses are almost $2.9 million, and the revenues are $234,000. Which
sure sounds like the fees are low, Mr. Chairman.
Well,
is that the answer?
Well, it's not a profit maker for the Common School Fund, for sure.
No, it is not. And I think that the question becomes then, and it's debatable, I assume, whether the fees are too low, the leases are too low, or this is a program that's being mismanaged. And we're certainly willing to look at either possibility, but it feels like the fees might be low.
In fairness to the department, they are trying to get general permits and special permits that would reduce the cost tremendously. But
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan and Representative Krager.
Chuck, it is real interesting to have you in this committee because this isn't a place that you usually end up being or that I end up crossing paths with you. I would like to just point out a couple of things because I think that it is very gratifying that the education community is waking up to this revenue source. With reference to the fill and removal permits and the expenses being so out of line to the revenues, that another issue that is critical for the education community to consider here is that fill and removal permits are usually one of the baseline hurdles that things people have to get through in order to get development on the ground, which creates jobs, which gets people working, which gets them paying revenue into the state system and beefs up the general fund that education also gets the lion's share of. So there are, I think, issues here related to the regulatory burden that we're putting on the economic development component, and we had a discussion about that also. The other aspect to this, I think, that is real interesting to point out is that the bulk of the money that comes into the trust fund comes from the harvesting of timber on state lands. And part of the problem that we've got as we set the harvest levels and write the management plans are that we grapple with the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act and what I call the environmental industry in the state of Oregon, which keeps raising the bar on what can be defined as productive use of these lands. And I think it would be interesting to see what role COSA would play in the political side of this. And I think that those of us that have been in land use, productive land use issues on state lands and public lands and private lands, particularly ag land and industrial forest lands, have continually fought an issue where we're being regulated off of the lands, and because of various lawsuits that have been filed, where the regulatory bar keeps getting higher, and the courts are what are essentially governing the processes at this point, rather than a legislative arena or a the regulatory process is following court directives, especially in relation to the federal lands. But there are huge issues now with the state forest lands and litigation governing the management of them. Given all that, it would be interesting to know whether COSA would be willing to step into a lawsuit over what's going on the trust lands right now, because we're clearly in a place where what we're able to realize in revenue from harvesting is diminishing at a huge rate. I mean, the levels that we're seeing being projected by the Department of Forestry to go into the Common School Fund from timber harvest are dropping at a 50% level every biennium.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I certainly can't commit COSA to a lawsuit at this quickly, and I won't, but I do think that it should gratify you to know that our view of the responsibility of DSL and the land board as trustees is that they have a responsibility and an undivided loyalty to the beneficiary. Their job is to manage these lands for the absolute optimum output for the school children of Oregon. And to the extent that anything interferes with that, and I know in other states this is occurring around this issue, we're seeing organizations like COSA and other education organizations intervening in these actions that involve limitations on development of particularly of the trust lands, and have taken a real interest and seeking either compensation for the Common School Fund for environmental set-asides or other land use set-asides that do not allow full development of those lands, or participating in other actions relative to it. This is an issue that is taking on a fairly substantial level of interest throughout the Western United States among education organizations as it relates to these common school funds. These are one of the resources that have just either been frittered away. In Oregon, we started off with 3.4 million acres of land. We're down to 700,000 acres. A great deal of it was just given away historically, resulting in to the detriment of the school children of Oregon. And we're not going to be the generation of whether we're lobbyists or superintendents or school board members or teachers or whomever is interested in this to watch this happen one more time, nor are we going to sit still and watch fees not be raised when they should appropriately be raised to pay expenses. It's an undivided loyalty to the children, and that's what we think is most important. We've got this little rallying cry we're using these days, which is, this is the kids' land, and this is the kids' money. This isn't a developer's money, this isn't Sierra Club's money, and this isn't a local JIPO outfit's money. And it isn't superintendent's money. So you get me launched on my, this is the kid's money pitch. And
get a rebate.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
If I could just interject, too, that the story that you just told on the state lands being withdrawn is the same story that you could tell about the public lands being withdrawn from the harvest base, too. And that also has had a profound impact on the county's abilities and the district's ability to contribute money into that end of the K-12 system. So it's a huge and critical issue for the education community to step up to the plate and demand that the land be used for the purposes to generate wealth, to educate kids, and get the services running.
Absolutely.
And with that, I would urge you to meet with Representative Johnson. She has a wonderful slogan for your...
Representative Krager. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to really echo where Representative Morgan is going, and I saw our chair smiling because we've had a conversation, I think, since I got here a little over 2 years ago. Where has education been regarding natural resources, even private land resources, and reasonable access to that to the public? And K through 12 funding is going to be a challenge. Chuck, you know that. And I had a town hall just the other day, and I was talking, and of course you get criticized, you get misquoted. I don't know a person in this building that doesn't want to support teachers or schools. It's how do we get there? And the Elliott, good example. We're sitting there somewhere probably around 25% to 30% of its potential growth and dollar value coming in. We're also producing an older tree which no longer has that value because the management plan was developed for owls, marlets, and salmon. It wasn't developed for optimum output for the schools. I think you need to be extremely aggressive with state forestry, with us, that optimization where you really start a few minutes ago, you need to go to the Board of Forestry with that.
Yes, sir.
Tell them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
We've got to do that. One other issue. Last year I tried to get $75,000 for an economic bear study because of predation on bears on forest land in Oregon. At the very least, it's $75 million a year. That impacts jobs, mill jobs, harvests. As part of that is on your land. And it's being shoved underneath the table where nobody talks about it. It's impacting your schools. And you need to be there. And you need to come by and visit with me, and I'll tell you what it's costing you.
Chuck, I have to tell you, the note that's passing around up here is our slogan, which is Clear Cut for Kids.
We've had slots for times. Everybody wants to help us. What we'd ask you to do is take... We would ask you to support the enhancement package, would be one thing.
When the Enviro sounds... Excuse me. I want you kids out with those signs.
Chuck, you have a handout for us. I see you were reading off.
I'd actually made notes on the department's. Nothing in writing.
Mr. Stonebring.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebring, executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Very interesting conversation, and I enjoy it. What's been going on just in the last few moments. Earlier testimony, they talk about wetlands, and they say protection of wetlands. We have to understand that the wetlands we're talking about are private property wetlands. And I could, in fact, I wrote down protecting wetlands equals restrictive use on private property. And the state has decided through its laws, of course, that there's a public benefit to having wetlands. One of them might be coming this summer. It's called West Nile virus, but that's another subject. But the landowners have never been compensated for that public benefit in any way. But private property owners, if they want to conduct an activity on those wetlands, they have to get permission from the government on their land. In fact, they have to get permission from two governments, and now they have to pay a fee. And in earlier committees, we were talking about increasing that fee. The Oregon Cattlemen has a bill that says that maybe the permitting process should just be done by one government and one fee, and that being the Corps of Engineers. And that might partly answer your fiscal problem that you mentioned earlier. That would be, as Representative Johnson asked when I was here testifying on another issue, if I had a magic wand, that would be one of the things I'd do, that we can reduce government and reduce spending. But on the other side, I have to say that I am here to speak on behalf of the division on a particular issue, and that's a position for the rangelands, the range conservationist position. This position is vitally important because if the grazers, the ranchers who graze those state-owned lands, they have to get a permit. They have to have a management plan. And if the management plans are not completed and followed, they will be in risk of losing that permit. In other words, be put off of the land. But that risk doesn't come from the division. It comes through the courts. And there's one enviro group after another that continually sue the Division of State Lands for so-called not following the plans for those resources. So we must have, it's an extremely essential position, we must have that position to work with our ranchers to make sure the paperwork is in place and the compliance, or that not only will the ranchers be put off the land, but then the revenue for that grazing would be lost as well.
Thank you. Question? Senator Johnson.
For Mr. Bennett, thank you, Mr. Chair. Following on your comments about maximizing fees, and the department's view of the whole portfolio of their fee opportunities, I'm curious whether or not your opinion would extend to the issue of navigability. There have been questions about having fees tied to navigability for enforcement. How would you feel about fees tied to navigability to benefit the common school fund?
Who would pay those fees?
Teachers.
Users.
Users. The river users would pay the fees?
Uh-huh.
Well, I'd have to really think about it. I really am not sure. You mean I would lease? I would, if I'm a riverfront owner, I would lease back my land?
No, if you were floating through, you would have a permit to be on a river for flotation purposes, and instead of dedicating it all to enforcement, it would be, according to your line of reason, a very high fee inuring to the benefit of the Common School Fund.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. With that question, we've got to leave some time for Mr. Donovan here.
I thought he was going to have a heart attack.
He supports school kids.
That's right. Absolutely, we do.
Why is that big?
Kayaks for kids.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
we'll let you try to top that.
My name is Phil Donovan, and the wit and wisdom that resides within this room is really
scary, isn't it?
Spectacular.
The scary part is the wisdom.
As you're all very well familiar, I represent the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. And we've been working on an issue for quite some time that was just recently referenced, navigable waterways. Since statehood, navigable rivers that are held in the public trust have not been very well meted out, if you will. A considerable cloud hangs over the state as it relates to where the public can legally be and not be, and what activities can take place there. The reason why I wanted to come forward today is to first off make clear our position on this issue, which is that we are not seeking more access to Oregon's riverways. We are only seeking clarity as to where folks can be. We are not seeking title to Oregon's waterways. Again, only where the public can be. Now, property groups, of course, have tremendous interest in this issue as well, in ensuring their rights. And the reason I wanted to come and speak with you today is because the Division of State Lands has been the agency put in the middle. And what I would put forward is that the Division of State Lands has endeavored long and hard
to broker a compromise and to not have to declare title to Oregon's riverways. This has been difficult because from the recreational standpoint, there are certain standards by which we need to meet. And for landowners, they have their concerns, and the idea of taking fees collected from private boaters and delivered to the Common School Fund may not sit well with them, because they want to see that that enforcement takes place with those monies. The Division of State Lands has been trying to balance recreationalists, private property interests, also the interests of the legislature and the land board, and that is a difficult place to be. And what I want to say is that we have been appreciative of the Division of State Lands' hard work on this issue. There is a navigability work group that has been meeting now for some 8 months. We've gone through a lot of public hearings recently, and we're now going to have to come back and try and figure out, does there exist that middle ground that can bring forward a legislative solution? We remain convinced that the legislative solution is the best solution to something similar to the Beach Bill or maybe Montana's stream access law. I think the bottom line is that today we can say that we've made more progress in the last 8 months than we have in the last 6 years that I've been working on behalf of the Northwest Steelheaders. And a lot of that goes to the hard work of the Division of State Land staff. And I would hope that you would recognize that and not beat them up too much for having been stuck in the middle of a very contentious issue. So with that, I would close and be happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Questions, comments? Introduce.
I attended one of those hearings. I was curious as to what Northwest Steelheaders reaction was to the cattleman's statement.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think you'd be referring to a second option that was kind of floated out that had to do with a floatage.
They carefully stated it wasn't a proposal, so I was trying to not call it a proposal.
Well, I actually appreciated the clarification that Glenn Stonebrink made at that meeting, because prior to that statement, we were really miffed because we felt that that was something that had threatened to compromise and perhaps did compromise the ability of folks to consider the proposal that was in front of them that had come out of the work group. Because clearly the floated easement proposal is, in my opinion, biased towards landowner interests. So, of course, if you were a landowner, you would probably like that a lot more. So in that regard, I felt it compromised it. But as you heard the cattleman's representative say, he was, I think, trying to finesse the issue.
But it is an idea that's out there. That night it was well received. I didn't attend any of the other hearings. So I was just curious. I mean, if you've got to go back to that group of people and talk to them, the proposal that was being floated by the work group didn't get the muster. But the one from the Cattlemen's Association that allowed access did. And so I was just curious as to what the official position of the Steelheaders was on that.
Chair Masterly, Senator Dukes, we don't have an official position on that. We actually have a executive committee meeting on Thursday evening, and we as a work group are sitting down on Friday afternoon, I think fundamentally with the question of do we proceed forward. I'm cautiously optimistic that the answer is yes. We've made tremendous progress. We need to maintain that momentum. We need to find a solution. The challenge with a floatage easement, which has been bantered around for a great number of years, is something that it would, of course, appeal to landowners in that room. At the same time, I question whether it would meet the Constitutional or the Admissions Act of Oregon, which refers to a navigable waterways and doesn't make reference to a floatage easement. We're gonna put everything back on the table, I think. There were some proposals, such as the fees that have been referenced, that you can't find a recreational letter sent in on the public record supportive of that. And while our association may have some support for that, we'd be a lone voice. So we may have to take a couple steps back. I suspect that the Oregon Farm Bureau and the Cattlemen's Association are going to have to take a couple steps back and try and figure out where there was some common ground and where there wasn't. And there was some common ground out there, I think. So therein lies the challenge, a tremendous one.
Other question, comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that,
your friend Craig.
Phil, make sure you do take the Kayaks for Kids idea back.
I'd be happy to, sir.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
And we've got about 7 or 8 minutes. Do you want to start fresh tomorrow, or would you like to?
I'll have the pleasure of the committee. I can start fresh tomorrow if you want to do that.
It's really up to you. We've got
tomorrow.
But before we do that, Ann, is there anyone else in the audience who did not get a chance to sign up? And we will have another opportunity tomorrow for public testimony as well. So. Okay, let's do that.
Thank you. With that, we close the public hearing and adjourn the committee meeting.